trade war or currency war? Or, hear me out now, why can't we have both? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the second day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Should you have better things to do with your early morning hours than check Twitter to see what the President of the United States has to say about the global economy? Well, I envy you. But news was made this morning in 280 character chunks in a series of pre-dawn tweets. The president accused Brazil and Argentina of letting the value of their currencies fall, presiding over a massive devaluation, were his exact words. He then paired that with a new batch of steel and aluminum tariffs he is imposing on those two countries. And then the president said he wants the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. That, in and of itself, is pretty normal. But this time, the hook was the president leaning on the Fed to protect the dollar against other currencies. So, tariffs, currencies, interest rates, and the Fed. That's a lot in two tweets, so we are going to take it a slice at a time. We start with Kimberly Adams and how all of those pieces relate to each other, or, you know, don't.
If you think back to the start of the trade war, most of the time, President Trump talked about national security as the reason for new tariffs. But not today. Melissa Rogers is an associate professor at Claremont Graduate University.
The president tweeted that he is imposing new steel tariffs on Brazil and Argentina on the idea that they're manipulating their currency to have lower prices on steel relative to the United States.
But according to Daniela Campello, a politics professor at the Getulio Vargas Foundation in Brazil,
in both cases, it's just finances flowing out of the country. It's something that's going on simply because investors are removing their money from both countries, Argentina and Brazil.
Basically, because the economy isn't so great in those countries right now. But in the U.S., the economy is pretty good, and the dollar is strong as a result. So what does the strength of the dollar have to do with interest rates? Gregory Dacko is chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. He says investors want to park their money where they know they can get a high rate of return. So
if U.S. interest rates are lower than the rest of the world, there will be less flows into the U.S. dollar, and therefore the dollar will depreciate, which will mean an advantage in terms of our exports.
Just like money flowing out of Brazil and Argentina is pushing down the value of their currencies.
The key issue, though, is that the value of the dollar is not really in the Fed's hands, but is really an issue that is in the remit of the U.S. Treasury, not the Fed.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell has been super clear that he has zero interest in lowering interest rates just to respond to global currency markets. But that doesn't mean the president won't ask. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Super clear indeed, Chair Powell has been. Okay, so there is a phrase for the underlying concept the president is trying to make happen here. Competitive devaluation is what he's advocating. A race to the bottom, if you will, in a currency war. So we have gotten Catherine Dominguez. She's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan on the phone to walk us through what that might mean in practice. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's talk about some of the mechanics of this. What happens when a currency is devalued by whatever means, by a government or by the market?
Both Argentina and Brazil have seen large weakening of their currency. They weren't literally devaluing their currency, right, but their currencies have gone down because both of those economies have been going through kind of low levels of crisis. What that means is that it becomes very expensive if firms have non-local currency debts. It's very difficult to import, but it does make one's exports more competitive.
So in theory, that could be what the president's trying to do here. Weaker U.S. dollar would make American exports more attractive, and then that would boost the economy, and things would be, in his perspective, going great guns.
And I think the particular targeting of Argentina and Brazil comes out of the fact that they seem to have benefited from the China-U.S. trade war, mm-hmm, in the sense that their farm exports have increased dramatically to China, given that China has now put tariffs on U.S. Right. farm products.
You know how people say nobody ever wins a trade war, right?
Yes, indeed.
As this transitions, and look, the president's done this before, but as this transitions to something more of a currency war, at least with these two countries, does anybody win a currency war? Does competitive devaluation work?
Largely, the experience has been no. The last big currency war we had was in the interwar period, and basically all countries tried to undercut each other between World War I and World War II to get a trade advantage. None of them, of course, achieved that, since all of them were doing the same thing, and it led to high inflation rates across the world. So if everyone's doing the same thing, no one's going to get the exchange rate advantage, right? And all countries are going to be basically pursuing expansionary monetary policy when it might not be the appropriate policy.
Right. Expansionary monetary policy being generally considered to be lower interest rates, right?
Correct.
Okay. With all respect to the real and the peso, devaluing the dollar is different, right? It's the global reserve currency. It's the thing that is almost universally accepted. What happens if the dollar weakens precipitously?
So we haven't really had an experience of that of late. Currently, market turnover in the dollar market is about $1 trillion a day. Ooh. And again, it's very unlikely that there would be a precipitous fall. It's more likely that there would be a number of, unfortunately, it would not be the set of shocks that President Trump would like to happen. The only reason we would expect a big fall in the value of the dollar is if the U.S. economy starts slipping dramatically. So it would be a bad sign all around if right. that were to happen.
Okay, so here comes the part of the interview where I ask you for your conjecture on this. What do you think the president's trying to do here?
Seems like a targeted message to farmers that he would like things to be better for them. And Argentina and Brazil kind of came in and took over their market. So it seemed like a good set of countries to go after, is my guess.
Catherine Dominguez, she's a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks, ma'am, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You no doubt noticed Wall Street didn't think much of trade and foreign exchange policy by tweet today, and that probably didn't help the mood, but there were some other things going on that weighed on equities. Mostly, a report on American manufacturing that showed a fourth straight month of factory production in this economy shrinking, about which, by the way, Kimberly was talking about the president and the Fed and the dollar and how that's not really the way things work. Well, she sent me this just as I was walking into the studio, a tweet from the president of the United States this afternoon, quote, "Manufacturers are being held back by the strong dollar, which is being propped up by the ridiculous policies of the Federal Reserve." I think we covered that on the program today, right? It's going to be the sad music when we do the numbers. It seems almost quaint to note that today is something widely known as Cyber Monday. Quaint because, come on, we're shopping online this whole holiday season, right? It ain't just today. But I mention that as a way to get to this. While early figures do show that brick-and-mortar sales were down 6% on Black Friday, online sales boomed. And that reality is changing the nature of seasonal work. From the Workplace Culture Desk Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
The seasonal retail gig is a mainstay of the holiday season, you know, stocking store shelves and helping hordes of customers find their perfect gifts. Now, those jobs still exist, but companies are increasingly hiring different kinds of seasonal workers.
Extra drivers and package handlers and material movers, order pickers, packagers.
Julia Pollack is an economist with job site ZipRecruiter. She said seasonal retail postings on the site are down by a third from 5 years ago, while jobs in transportation and warehousing have made up the difference. Target announced earlier this year it planned to double its holiday e-commerce hiring. Macy's expects a third of its holiday jobs to be in e-commerce.
It's a little more physical. It's a little more technical.
Greg Portell with management consulting firm A.T. Kearney says e-commerce has created more specialization in retail. Workers either handle stocking or customer service, but not both. These new seasonal retail jobs seem to pay about the same as the old ones, but it's hard to know for sure, says Beth Gutelius, who studies economic development at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Many temporary logistics workers are hired through staffing firms.
which makes it really hard to get a very clear picture of wages and working conditions in that industry.
In October, there was actually a 17% dip in hiring in the transportation sector compared to last year. But that's actually good news, according to Andrew Challenger of outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
We really think that has more to say about the labor market than it does about retailers' desire to hire.
In other words, there aren't enough workers looking for those holiday jobs. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
E-commerce has, in a way, changed all of our jobs because, admit it or don't, we all do spend some part of our work, and that's in air quotes, work day, shopping online. So, fess up, would you? We want to hear your thoughts on how online shopping has changed your workplace. Do you get more done? Do you get less done? Do you have all your packages delivered to work and overload the front desk? Head to marketplace.org. Let us know. The phrase food desert, you know, right? Places where it's hard, if not impossible, to get affordable and nutritious food. That imagery of shortage has been barred by the liberal think tank Center for American Progress to describe access to childcare. The group says 51% of the people in this economy live where there isn't enough access to childcare, where there are way more young kids than there are spots at licensed daycare centers. The cold, hard business model reality of that is that what you've got there is built-in demand. From the Mountain West News Bureau, KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Last spring, Tricia Shields was at work at a kidney treatment center.
I think I was daydreaming at my desk.
She was tired of only seeing her kids at bedtime, and her job in healthcare was really wearing on her.
I just needed a change. I wanted a bright start to something new.
She was playing music on her phone when an ad came on.
And I just heard it, and it was like,
do you want to be your own boss? Do you love being around kids and wish you could turn that passion into a career?
I'm like, yes, I do.
The ad was from a company called My Village. It's one of at least three startups, including WeCare and Wonder School, that are trying to get more people to start childcare centers.
Our mantra is that we make it easy to start, run, and grow a home-based childcare program.
That's Beth Szymanski, co-founder and CFO of My Village, which currently has 80 locations across Colorado and Montana. Her company, and the other ones too, are mostly focused on childcare in a provider's home, not nannies or big childcare centers. Szymanski says there's a simple reason for that: cost.
Nannies have a really high personalized cost because it's one person trying to make a living off of your family. Childcare centers have really high overhead. They have rent and they have utilities.
But in-home childcare is more affordable for families. The rub is figuring out how to make these small businesses easier to run, which is the idea behind the startups. My Village, for example, deals with things like marketing, taxes, paperwork, and setting people up with mentors. It also pays for the childcare provider's insurance. In exchange, the startup gets 10% of the enrollment fees each month.
When I saw what they were doing, it was like, wow, yes.
That's Louise Stoney. She's a consultant in early childhood education and co-founder of Opportunities Exchange. It's looking to change the business model and policies around childcare so that providers don't have to shoulder all the administrative costs.
How do we take small settings and how do we help them to succeed? How do we link them together? How do we redefine in some way what it means to be a childcare center?
Simon Workman directs the Early Childhood Policy Group with the Center for American Progress. He says the need for childcare is especially acute in rural areas, where home-based providers are sometimes the only option, and many of them are closing their doors.
That is leaving families in those small communities with no care whatsoever.
He says it can be tough for in-home providers. Childcare needs to be affordable for families and of high quality while also providing a living wage. At her home in Parker, Colorado, Tricia Shields says she hopes she'll be able to do all of that.
This is the preschool space.
She put about $15,000 into renovating her basement and jazzing it up with secondhand furniture and colorful decorations.
So over here we have kind of the learning, crafts, puzzles, think coloring, things.
There's
like
a reading corner, a box of costumes.
Animals, music, dinosaurs, puppets, cars.
She's now licensed to work with babies and kids, and by November, she had one slot to fill before she hit the state limit of 6 children. She charges about $1,000 a month per child. One of the kids is her son. And a few weeks in, she said things were going well.
Yeah, I love it.
But it's not all rainbows and unicorns. She works alone, so she doesn't get many breaks. And financially, it's stressful.
The financial hit has been really hard. You know, we renovated our basement, and that took everything out of us. It drained us, and now we're just kind of playing catch-up.
She expects it'll take a couple years to get settled financially. In Greeley, Colorado, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, at one point, the whole like ping pong tables in your workplace was a joke.
And now there they are in suburban office parks. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here we go. Dow Industrial's off 268 points today, 0.9%, 27,783. The NASDAQ off 97 points, 1.1%, 85.67. The S&P 500 down 27 points, that is 0.8%, finished at 31.13. So, higher tariffs on imported steel from Argentina and Brazil. That sent U.S. steelmakers higher in today's trading. AK Steel shot up nearly 5%. U.S. Steel banked just over 4% on the day. A shorter holiday season is going to test big shipping companies that have to deliver all that stuff we buy online this season in fewer days. And so on this Cyber Monday, stocks in the two leading package delivery companies dropped, and by an equal amount too. UPS and FedEx each gave back 1.2%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tight as this labor market is, there are a whole lot of industries out there that are scrambling for workers. For just one example for us today, trucking. We are short, says the American Trucking Association, something like 60,000 drivers right now, a number that's only going to grow over the next decade. And even though women are nearly half of the American labor force, they are less than 10% of all truck drivers. So today's installment of our series, My Economy, comes from out on the open road.
My name is Kelly Lynn McLaughlin, and I'm a truck driver. Everything about trucking is a math problem, and as you go down the road, your math problem changes. The obstacles, the driving conditions, how you articulate around corners or backup, it's all math, and I enjoyed solving those problems. I take students out as part of my job as a training engineer with Schneider, and I typically have each student for about a week. My work weeks are 70-hour weeks. They're long days. They're 14-hour days, typically. And I'm teaching them how to do customer service and live on the road. And it's a challenge. We're short on drivers in our country. There's lots of opportunity for jobs. And women should consider this as a profession. If you have your, really and truly, if you have your CDL license, your commercial driving license, you can get a job. The majority of the people that I train are men. They come from all different walks of life, the men and the women. Some have PhDs, some have masters, some are tired of working in the office. Some are struggling and they're just looking for a job to be able to provide something for their family. Others are bored with life and they just want to get out there and have some independence and see the country. And driving is a great place to do that. Our highway infrastructure is old, a little bit dated. It's not really, it was built at a time when we didn't have as many trucks on the road. So it hasn't kept up with that. They haven't built new places for us. But yet, they still want us to deliver everything on time. I realized that trucking is the blood that runs through our country. Our country can't survive without it. And everything in our homes and our offices, all comes to us at a truck at some point in time, and I underestimated and took that for granted.
That was Kelly Lynn McLaughlin. She's a long-haul truck driver and training engineer. Shoot us a note if you get a second with the story of your economy, would you? There is a place you can do that at marketplace.org. The classic suburban office park is nobody's idea of a bustling, with it happening place to go to work. Mostly, they're known for being far away from all of that. On purpose. Just some buildings, some trees, and lots of parking lots. But even real estate companies know the adage, adapt or die. Amanda Abrams wrote about the comeback of the suburban office park for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
There are, as I said in the introduction, few things as bleak as the American suburban office park. And yet you write it's changing and one hopes for the better, yeah?
Yep, I think so. I think things are changing a little bit on that front due to some forces in America right now.
Well, let's talk about why things are changing, right? It's a combination of market forces and demographics and frankly, people just wanting a little bit more out of their workplace.
I think so, yeah. I mean, millennials in general kind of like more of an urban setting, but cities are getting a lot more expensive. Millennials are getting older and looking maybe to buy a house or looking at what schools might be like. I think that's pushing folks towards the suburbs a little bit. And then also it's a super tight labor market, so real estate can maybe make a real difference. It doesn't have to be necessarily downtown to have a lot of the things that folks might be looking for.
Right, those amenities that your piece talks about. You know, it's really funny when you think about an office park as it was built in the, 70s and 80s. There was nothing there, man. It was just an office park. You couldn't get a cup of coffee. You couldn't go out for lunch. It was just there.
Yes, I worked in an office park in the 90s. I remember. Yeah, but that's the thing. They're kind of being pushed to do a lot more. And they are. I think they're really responding around the country. I mean, at one point, the whole like ping pong tables in your workplace was a joke. But now I think people really do expect to have some of that stuff, like outdoor seating or Wi-Fi in an employee lounge where you can hang out and open offices where there's more natural light, maybe a coffee bar downstairs.
Is it paying off? Do we have enough data yet? Do we know?
Yeah, I think it was CBRE's data that in the third quarter of this year, suburban office park vacancies are the lowest they've been since like 2001.
Which is great. Regional differences too, right? I mean, it's one thing out here in California. It's another thing in Durham where you are. It's another thing in, the Great Northeast somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can't speak for like a very rural region, but I know places like the Midwest or Des Moines, they actually have a very low unemployment rate themselves. So actually there's a pretty tight labor market and a war for labor. So they're actually seeing a lot of the same stuff. And that's true in Minnesota. That's true in Wisconsin, a lot of places that you maybe wouldn't expect.
Right. Is it that we're looking for a city environment, I guess, in a suburban setting? Is that kind of what it is?
Yes, that is totally what it is. Yeah. And, honestly, I'm not a suburban office park kind of person, but I think they do have a lot to offer. Because if you can really, amenitize an office park and add all that stuff, but still be near people's homes where they might be living, in decent schools and not have a huge commute, then in a way, I think that's not too bad.
Amanda Abrams writing in the New York Times about the revitalization of suburban office parks. Amanda, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which I will freely admit has no obvious marketplace angle, but which I love nonetheless. Notice this over the weekend that the founder of the Apostrophe Protection Society has thrown in the towel. John Richards said, and these are his words, "At 96, I am cutting back on my commitment." So that's the first thing. Also, he said, "We and our many supporters worldwide have done our best, but the ignorance and laziness present in modern times have won." So look, people, if you're going to use them right, would you? All right, we're done. The Dow Industrial's off 268 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 97 points, about 1.1%. The S&P 500 down 27 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.